Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, we are so excited. We have Chelsea Fagan here. Chelsea, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
So good.
We are so excited to be talking to you because I think, Amanda, I don't know how you feel, but I feel like lately in a lot of my sessions, finances have been coming up quite a bit. I definitely think this current administration has a huge role to play in that and some of the uncertainty that's been introduced. And I think just in general, finances is something that a lot of women feel a lot of anxiety and trepidation around. And I was like, who could we bring on to talk about that? And I think Chelsea is the ideal candidate to chat with us about that. So I guess to start, what I would love to know, Chelsea, is like, how did you get started? Like, I know you had a blog and I know you've built this incredible platform, The Financial Diet. Like, what is your money story maybe?
Sure. So yeah, as you mentioned, I started the blog back in 2014 to kind of rehab my relationship with money, which had always been very complicated. I come from a low-income background and as a preteen and teenager, lived in a very affluent area, which I always say that like when we were at our poorest, we were in just like a poor neighborhood. So we actually felt normal. But then when we were lower middle class, we lived in a town that had very, very affluent areas. And like at my high school, a lot of really affluent kids. And so you actually feel a lot poorer, even though you're technically not, because, you know, so much of it is about social comparison. So when I graduated from high school, the first thing I did was take out a credit card. It was a Hello Kitty branded Visa credit card. And I maxed it out, threw it away. And I just got into a really bad cycle of compulsive spending, debt, and just kind of shame. Like I've been arrested for, you know, financially related issues. I, you know, used to rely on check cashing services because I was so overdrawn. Like I just was very financially unhealthy. And so I started The Financial Diet to kind of hold myself accountable and talk about it publicly. And it has grown from there into a media company.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Genuinely, that's like such an incredible story. And I think like the first question I have, what was the mindset work like around having to pull yourself out of that? Because I think, especially like the background, you know, growing up with not much, the scarcity mindset that can come with that, the lack of access to information, the lack of confidence around it. Like, what was that internal experience to have to pull yourself out from that?
You know, for me, I've never had the traditional scarcity mindset of like, I was never a hoarder with money. I was never, I was more, for me, it really manifested in like a sense of just like envy and resentment and unfairness, which I still have a chip on my shoulder about. Like our video essay for the month of March is about generational wealth. And like, I really feel to this day, a strong sense of like, especially where I live in New York City, like there's just such a level of just like constant gaslighting that's happening, even, you know, amongst social groups. And it just, this sort of collective delusion that we have to live in, that we're all sort of playing on the same field when that's obviously not true. So for me, a lot of kind of the initial emotional sort of process of improving my relationship with money was to really sort of unlearn a lot of the narratives that we had been taught about wealth, about what makes someone successful, about social mobility, all of these things. And then simultaneously kind of let go of shame. And like, I don't have a college degree. I didn't grow up with like a lot of the things that we consider like traditional markers of like culture, sophistication, or education. And so also letting go of those shames and sort of learning to be proud of my background and the tools that I'm working with, you know, because I think, especially as it, you know, it's, and this is something that we talk about in the video essay, but so much of what we associate with, again, things like culture, things like sophistication, like, for example, like having traveled to other countries, and even RIP, I love Anthony Bourdain, but like, he was like one of the most famous people for being like going to only one country is like reading only one chapter of a book or something like that. But like, babe, less than 40% of Americans have a passport. Like these kinds of things, whether it's a college education or travel or, you know, having the time to pursue hobbies or get really good at social skills or any of these things that we associate with are almost a character trait, are just money at the end of the day. And a lot of people, like some of the, I like to say some of the most well-traveled people I know are some of the most ignorant. Like I know a lot of people who are, you know, wearing their MAGA hats to Southeast Asia this summer. You know what I mean? So I think a lot of it was just about unlearning the narratives I had internalized about money.
I love that. I think too, Chelsea, like you just are someone who you give language to things I didn't know I felt until I like heard you say it on TikTok. And I just hearing you talk about that, like you have such a nuanced perspective of money, of culture. You're able to kind of point out, I think, some of these invisible systems and things that are happening behind the scenes. Can you talk a little bit more about money and mental health and how they're kind of related?
Well, you can't really have stable mental health if you're financially unstable. You just can't.
100%. Yeah.
And I do think like that's why like one of my pet peeves in literature is just like literary fiction that's about women who are very affluent and like they're married with kids and live in a beautiful home and like everything's great. And so they're like, something's wrong. And then they go like cheat on their husband or something.
It's just not relatable.
The Nicole Kidman cinematic universe. And listen, I loved Baby Girl, but I think that there is a real fascination with people who have all of their material comforts and then some met who are still unhappy, because I think it makes us feel better and sort of enables us to delude ourselves that, you know, money really doesn't buy happiness. And, you know, we might be much more unhappy if we weren't, if we were financially stable. And the truth is that's kind of a false premise. The truth is that money doesn't buy happiness, but it enables it. It creates the conditions in which to experience it. And, you know, if you're worried about, because it's been a long time since I've experienced financial stress with regards to paying my rent, but I own a business. And I have had periods where I've had to make payroll out of my own bank account, you know, or, you know, you see a quarter coming where, you know, a client's not paying you and you have to pay your contractors. And so even that kind of financial stress, you know, I've experienced pretty recently. And when those kind of financial factors are bearing down on you in any form, almost literally nothing else matters. And you can't even start. It's like the hierarchy of needs. And I remember I was having a panic attack related to like a business issue. And I went to one of those like Zoom psychiatrists because I was like, I just got to like, I was like, I couldn't breathe. I will never forget. They were like, they gave me a 60-day script of Prozac, which I never touched because I was like, babe, like, first of all, is this legal? But also, like,
yeah, it's a long-term medication. That's not a PRM.
No follow-up, no real warning about it. It's still sitting untouched in my kitchen drawer. But like, I also was like so angry at her because I was like, lady, I need a tranquilizer. Like, I used to take temazepam for sleep issues many years ago. And I was like, give me a temazepam or something. Like, I need to just like go to sleep. What I really was saying to the psychiatrist was like, what we're talking about in my situation, I'm a mentally healthy person. I'm actually probably dealing with this pretty well. Unless you can write me a check for $200,000 in the next 20 minutes, I'm not going to get better. So I have to sedate myself in order to move through the next steps. And that is obviously a slightly, you know, expanded version of it because we're talking about running a business, but on a day-to-day basis, if you're not able to make rent, who gives a shit about mental health?
Well, I worked in the emergency room for quite some time, and we would have homeless individuals come in and who all had comorbidities with health issues, substance use, addiction, you know, no family connections whatsoever. And I remember there would be like some of the physicians that I spoke to would say things like, well, do they not have somebody that we can call to come pick them up? And I'm like, no. Like,
no,
that bridge was burned a long time ago. Yeah. And then the extra complicated layer of like, they probably do have people that they could call, but those people have asked not to be called.
Yeah.
Like, so it's putting yourself in the position of, yeah, like there are moments where a lot of people's issues would be alleviated by having a stable place to live, having a job that they can rely on, and having access to services and resources that can cushion that to allow them to go out into the world and get healthy and get better and follow through on their appointments and know that they have reliable transportation to get where they need to go. Like, it's not as simple as just go get a job.
No.
Like, that doesn't, no. That, yes, theoretically, that's a part of the equation, but it is a massive equation that has so many variables to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think that is what's interesting is when you're a therapist, you do really see this side of it, and you see like, what is the point of my work when I'm talking to someone? And yeah, like they don't have their basic needs met. It's completely superfluous to be talking about their dreams or their hopes or their values, or, you know, their goal is to eat, to sleep, to have a safe place, to have, you know, if they have kids, their kids be okay. And I think that is one of the most, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about, you know, self-help culture. And I know you've critiqued it as well, and just how overly simplistic things are. And, you know, I think in your position and in our position, nothing teaches you that more than like actually getting to know people, actually hearing about their situations, and seeing that a simple let them or something like that does not just solve all of their problems.
I've had it with that.
We just did an episode on it. People, we had some pushback, but
yeah, whatever. They're wrong.
Exactly.
I always say that I think people are usually in not enough therapy or too much therapy. You rarely find someone who's hitting the sweet spot. And I feel like, you know, with the not enough, like basically all boomer men, it's like, if you could only have one tool for handling this that isn't like golf or whatever, like the world would be such a better place. Yeah. But for the too much, like, and that is something that like I only started to realize was even a thing when I entered more affluent circles in New York City, like where you encounter people every day where it's like, babe, like, I think actually you've done enough thinking and talking about yourself. And at this point, maybe we volunteer, maybe we talk to another person about their lives, like, because the amount of time and energy, and I think that goes back to like the, all this media that we have and our cultural fascination with these rich, thin white women who have everything and are still unhappy and are obsessed with figuring out why. It's like, because they're, I mean, at some point when all of our needs are met to that extent, you do kind of go on a search for meaning. And being endlessly interested in your own life and your own sort of mental minutia is not going to give you that fulfillment. It has to come from actually doing something.
Totally.
At some point, there has to be application. And with some of my clients who have struggled in the financial sector as well, I think there is so much analysis paralysis around money. And this idea of like, well, I have to make sure like I've researched the exact right high yield savings account and that I get this, I have to max out my percentage or, you know, the right investment account, or even just talking about like a basic checking savings situation or credit card. Like, there's so many of my clients that come to me completely overwhelmed. Often it's the first time in their life that they're feeling financially settled in some way, but now they have no idea what to do next. And everything feels like daunting and overwhelming. And so I would love to hear like your thoughts on when you hear that someone is kind of in that like analysis paralysis, information collection stage around money. What would you suggest in terms of like action?
I mean, if you can afford it, I mean, I use a financial advisor. I would just get a financial advisor. Like, it's not like, because I mean, here's the thing. It's very important to understand that money management is not math, really. It's not, it's not hard. It's not complicated. It's, but it is, you have to think about it a lot. So yeah. Like, mm-hmm. I am always the kind of person who prefers, if there's something that is going to take a lot of time and mental load and I can afford to outsource it to someone for whom it would be easy. Like, for example, I've never, like, I edit my own TikToks, but that's not really editing, but like our YouTube yeah. videos, even at the very beginning of having a channel, I always outsourced editing because mm-hmm. that would have taken me, you know, days and days on end to do a shit job, whereas a professional could do it in an hour or two yeah. for a fraction of the cost. And so I do think an advisor is helpful in that way also, because, you know, it allows you to just kind of have someone to prevent you from your own worst impulses, which is the other thing that often mm-hmm. messes people up financially, especially when it comes to things like investing. Mm-hmm. People want to, we have a real sort of human instinct that the more we act on something, the more agency we exert in a situation, the better mm-hmm. the outcome will be. And the opposite is true. Most of wealth building is just leaving things for very, very, very long periods of time and not touching them, no matter how scary it looks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that would be my advice for those who can afford it. If you can't afford it, then I think the number one thing to start doing is to at least get like a pretty comprehensive money management tool. Like, obviously Mint's gone, but I used to use Mint. Monarch mm-hmm. is good. Some people use You Need a Budget. Like, there are different ones, but like just a money management tool that allows you to see all of your money in one place and to start thinking about it from like a bird's eye holistic view. Because usually for most people, there's some debt, there's some yeah. income, there's some investments, there's all that kind of stuff. So getting one tool to see it all in one place.
I feel like money can often be a thing that it's very black and white on the internet. And there's not a lot of nuance. And I think, Chelsea, you are just really great at talking about like the nuance of things. Do you feel like that has come from like your own background and your own experience? Or how did you develop such a nuanced take about this stuff?
Well, I mean, to be fair, a lot of the black and white nature of a lot of financial commentaries, because it's a space that's full of scammers
yeah.
who are trying to sell you something. The truth is, the actual money management part is like 10%. The rest of it is like social, emotional, mm-hmm. Mental, you know, it's all of the stuff that goes into it. Anyone can figure out, like, literally spend less than you earn. You've graduated. Congratulations. Yeah. Like, yeah. it's really not that complicated.
Yeah.
What is complicated is existing within a complex social, professional, familial network that, you know, every day is putting all kinds of, you know, constraints and options in front of us and is convincing us constantly that we need things. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many ways in which our internal litmus test about money is really compromised, and intentionally mm-hmm. so. When we look at how we spend our money, like the rise of things like fast fashion, of online shopping, of pay-as-you-go, of one-click pay, like all mm-hmm. of these things were designed in a laboratory to override our instincts, mm-hmm. to convince us that we need things, and to get us on this quick hit dopamine cycle that is incredibly difficult to break away from a mental perspective, but again, also from a social perspective. When mm-hmm. this is what's normalized, it's really hard to step back from it. So I really like to think about, okay, well, how are we sort of curating an environment for ourselves where we're setting ourselves up for success?
I think you bring up such a fascinating point, Chelsea, with this idea of like this curated exposure that we're getting all the time, i.e. the algorithm. And I think something that I've found that is so common, not only like in my personal life that I see with myself, but like with my clients too, is this insane comparison game. And this is like across the board, right? Like it can be comparing down to relationships, down to how you raise your kids, to like the wealth growth of people in their 30s and like, you know, where people are at and they're affording this and they're able to do that and I can't do this and da 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 da. And I think something that has been so skewed by the algorithm is like the typical pace of life. And for a really, it's exactly like you said earlier, like wealth more often than not is just a time game. And it's about you being willing to be patient and let your money sit and accrue interest and let that interest accrue interest and continue to grow over time. It is actually very rare that someone does something where they get a windfall of millions of dollars and they're able to make up all of this quote unquote lost time, right? and get ahead in that way. That's actually a very rare situation. Most people aren't seeing the benefits of money management and wealth management until their 50s. And I think that's something that has been completely missed by, I think, millennials and even more like Gen Z, because now they have this bizarre influencer life that they get to see where they're flying all over the world and they're staying at the best hotels and they get invited to the best restaurants and the best events and they have the cars and they have the clothes and they have the bags and all this stuff. But most of that isn't real, right? Like the three of us know from behind the scenes, like most of that is gifted. It's someone gave it to you. It's borrowed. It's like, it's so complex beyond just, oh, I have another car. But I think when it comes to money, we've lost sight that we're not meant to be completely financially stable in our 30s. Like, we're not meant to have like hit this peak where it's like, I now would never have to work again if I did it correctly, right? And I think that gets into the whole like FIRE conversation, which isn't inherently bad, but I think that that is a system that can create an intense amount of stress and anxiety for people who think they have to be retired by like 38 or 40 in order to like fully live life. And so I think this whole like social media algorithm has just completely distorted our relationship to time and wealth and the relationship that we have with money and where we expect ourselves to be. I don't know what either of you think of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is connected with like, right, our fear of aging probably too, in terms of like the whole adage of like your life is over when you're 40. And I know, Chelsea, you talk about that a lot on TikTok, which I appreciate in my 30s. So I think that's part of it maybe too. But yeah, I think it's interesting to think about how different generations also treat money differently.
I mean, so it's undeniable that influencer culture has completely warped the perception of especially Gen Z and Gen Alpha when it comes to not just money, but also appearance, lifestyle expectations, all of this. I think one, and I think the most important one is, my friend always says, there are many different types of fame or notoriety that you can achieve or aspire to in life. And one of them is the just add water fame, which is what you would call like a reality star or an influencer who you're not really like, not really cooking with
fun. Yeah, you're, you know, famous for, like, you're not giving you're us for much. Being famous kind of thing.
You're famous for being famous. You're famous for, you know, sort of living your life as a Truman Show style documentary, you know, and like a lot of, when you look at like the really popular ones, you know, a lot of it is, you know, just partying, binge drinking, shopping, you know, traveling to, you know, destination after destination. It's this lifestyle that, I mean, we talk about in personal finance all the time, the hedonistic treadmill of, you know, being perpetually unsatisfied as you have more and experience more. And, you know, aside from the finances of it, as you point out, being very shaky, and let's be clear, even in the best cases, usually these people are not saving much, but it's also, I mean, it is speed running a sort of hedonistic, you know, ego death, essentially, where like, if you're at a place where that's your lifestyle, and not only is it your lifestyle, but it's your value proposition to the world, and you're not building any other skills, and you're not learning any other things, you know, you've really kind of created a bit of a prison for yourself. And I think for a lot of young people, what scares me most about it is not necessarily the skewed financial aspiration, because I think that was always going to be inevitable with social media, because now we're just seeing so many lifestyles. I think it's honestly more so the idea that this is, that kind of life is aspirational. You know, you see children now who walk around filming themselves all day. And the, you know, I even consider myself, I started YouTube in 2015 as an education channel. And I consider that to already be a micro generation of influencers, because that doesn't, like, YouTube education doesn't even exist anymore. Like, and we were like, for us, when we started, like, it was, there were the people who were like the 24/7, here's 100% access to my life YouTubers, but they were pretty few and far between. It was still kind of, there was a separation between what you put out there on the internet and what your actual life was. And there wasn't this completely unfettered expectation of access. And now I think what's really changed is this idea that the just add water fame of just essentially making a living documentary of your own life at all times, that that is something to aspire to or something that's not incredibly bad for mental health.
I think that's a really good point, because I remember when I was growing up, I mean, I remember when Kim Kardashian started to get famous, and I remember like popular culture was like, she is famous for being famous. This is not good. We don't appreciate that about her,
right,
which has obviously changed a lot. But I also think even, you know, back then when we were growing up, but I remember people being like, would you ever want to be famous? Would you rather be rich or famous?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Those questions somehow I remember being asked. And I remember there was a general consensus of like, I would love to be rich, but I would never want to be famous. It would be so intrusive and terrible. And it is so interesting that I think if you asked people now, I think, I mean, especially in, I think if you ask people if they want to be an influencer or a TikTok star, I think it's absolutely something people, maybe the culture has shifted into thinking this is good and something we want.
There's been such a premium placed on quote unquote authenticity that I think there's almost this expectation that if you are not sharing every part of yourself, that there is something inherently inauthentic about it. And also authenticity is this thing that we try to, like, for example, you know, people make fun of the millennial pause, yeah, but if you watch like Gen Z videos, they always pretend like they're in the middle of doing
yeah,
something.
They do.
Like you just caught them.
Yeah, that visual hook, like, you got to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's always like, it always has this aura of like, you interrupted them, you know, making something or eating something. And it's like, babe, you set up the camera to film. You decided to say something. Like, I'm not walking into your bedroom asking your opinion on this.
The famous covering the mouth while they're eating. They're like,
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Which I think is, in a roundabout way, an attempt to convey a sort of casual offhand authenticity. Like you're just having dinner with them. And, you know, for us millennials, especially those of us who started on the internet quite early, there is, you know, we present in a more formal way. Like, yeah, a lot of people think that my TikToks are scripted. They're not. It's just I'm very used to speaking and editing in a way that's like I'm giving like a little speech. Yeah.
Well, also, I have to say, you always look incredibly glamorous. And you, I'm always like, how does her hair lay that perfectly?
I just like, feel like you're Nancy Myers as like your life.
So
that's my assessment.
You. That's very kind. But it is, I mean, but a lot of people, younger people especially, do perceive that as inauthentic.
Yeah.
Do people say that to you sometimes online? Really?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. All the time. Yeah. People will say inauthentic, or they'll say, I look way older than I am, or I style myself way older than I am. Or, you know, like, I think that there's also, as you mentioned, the sort of ageism problem amongst young people is actually terrifying. Like, the way that they are so scared of not just the physical aspect of aging, but the sort of irrelevancy aspect of aging, it is doing a number on their mental health. And I think for them, part of the sort of relatability and authenticity thing is very wrapped up in youth and youth culture. And so anytime that you sort of intentionally separate yourself from that, that automatically is, I think, not perceived as relatable. And also, like, relatability goes back to finances, right? And like, that is partially why you will, you know, for example, I am an affluent person. I don't buy cheap things if I can avoid it. I don't have a lot of cheap things in my house. And now that's not to say like a lot of my stuff is like from Facebook Marketplace and things like that, but I try not to buy fast fashion. I try not to, you know, shop at these, you know, not great brands. And especially for a younger crowd, there's an element of that that is very off-putting. And that's why, you know, a lot of these influencers who are earning high six, seven figures a year are still wearing, you know, Fashion Nova or Shein. And that's actually considered a positive thing by their audience because that makes them more relatable and more accessible. Mm-hmm. Whereas to me, I think that's sort of like a complete ethical violation because you're one of the few people who could afford to hold higher standards for what you buy and promote. And yet it's sort of viewed as, again, violating that code of relatability.
If this conversation is making you think, I could actually really use a therapist, I have great news for you. My practice, Therapy for Women Center, offers therapy in the Philadelphia area and in 43 states across the country. This is also where Sam works, so if you're interested in working with Sam or with me, we sometimes take a limited number of clients every year, and we would love to work with you. Or if we're not a fit, we have, like I said, licensed therapists across the country. Learn more at therapyforwomencenter.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Amanda, going back to what you brought up earlier about, like, you know, kids being asked these questions, and very recently, all of us kind of hearing this idea that fame itself was bad and it's not something you want. And look at Princess Diana. Like, she
Yeah, maybe
died
that was why.
Because she was
famous.
I feel
like I talked about Princess Diana as a child a lot.
Same. But then, you know, I have friends who are teachers, and multiple kids in their classroom, like their elementary age teachers, kids are saying, I want to be a YouTuber. I want to be an influencer. I want to do this. And then when you say why, it's like, because I make a lot of money. Mm. And it's tragic because it's like they have no interests. Like, it's, there's nothing unique.
You know, especially as it pertains to things like digital culture, with the rise of things like AI, I think there's not a whole lot to be gained from a mental health perspective to speculate too much on any of this, because I think, you know, and I was talking about this recently with a friend of, like, you know, AI and kind of more broadly the way that our digital culture is changing around us in ways that are kind of inconceivable to even people of our generation. It is going to be on the scale of, you know, in the 1960s when, you know, people were angry about computers being set up in their office, and you know, there were people who wanted to completely refuse that reality outright and ignore it. There were people who were very bullish on the idea. There were people who were doomers on the idea. Like, but the truth is, the way all of this will shake out, especially with how fast things are advancing now, like, if you have a two-year-old, the context that she's going to live in from a digital perspective is completely inconceivable to us.
Yeah.
And especially as she ages, like, it won't map at all onto what we currently have. And in many ways, I think that that is probably one of the biggest privileges of our lives and our generation, is that we were old enough to experience the digital age, but it was still early enough that it was separate from ourselves in a way. It was something that you intentionally sought out and then you left. And the level of integration that young people are going to experience is just, like, I think we have to kind of just accept that no amount of planning or predicting will ever be able to imagine it.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. Like, in terms of a mental health tip, I think that, you know, even as a therapist, I get very caught up sometimes in trying to game out what I can do and things like that. And I think that's a really good point, because none of us could have even conceived AI being what it is a few years ago.
I think we see it a lot with, like, the family vloggers. It's just the generational warp speed between what was acceptable for our generation and what will be acceptable for theirs. And I think the most important thing is just to kind of, again, understand that, you know, every generation looks back at their parents and thinks, how could you, about, like, any number of things. And I do think for ours, a lot of it is going to be very digitally related.
Yeah, I agree.
I think the pressure point on parents and parenthood is, the amount of conversations I have with my clients, because they are so overwhelmed, understandably so, by the amount of information that they are getting, and friends are DMing them this and texting them that, and you should do this and you shouldn't do that, and you should, and it's like, evolution is a very hard thing to beat. Like, your child is going to walk, your child is going to talk, your child is going to figure out their motor skills. And if they don't, you will know. Like, you will figure it out. And if you care even an ounce about your child, you will get them to the doctor and figure it out as you go. You don't have to have the answers for when your child is 10 when they are currently 6 months old. Like, you don't need to go there. But I think that even ties into that larger picture that we were speaking to earlier of just like this incessant comparison and this incessant deluge of information and opinion and belief systems and this constant need that if you're not constantly pivoting and adjusting based on this new information that you hear, you're doing it incorrectly. And it's like, well, no, why don't you pause and figure out if that even works for your life? Like, it's exactly like you said, if you are following a very affluent influencer talking about the nannies that they use and, you know, different
or not talking about the nannies they use and or just not, yeah. magically they have many kids and can travel super easily.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can't compare yourself to that because you're comparing like apples in a 2x4. Like, it's not even in the same realm of possibility. And I think so many women specifically get caught up in that of I'm not enough, I'm not doing enough, I don't have enough, I will never be enough. And it's heartbreaking because in reality, all of this is like smoke and mirrors. Just like you said, like the nannies, right? It's sad.
It is sad. I will say though, that to me that goes, because like, let's be clear, no single mom working two jobs to pay rent gives a shit about like, am I enough? Yeah. You know what I mean? She's just like, is there food in my fridge? Like, so if you're in a position to just be constantly obsessing over minutiae and like ultimately things that are pretty irrelevant, like things that are not make or break, like I think to me that's the biggest sign of like, we got to think about something other than ourselves at some point. And that is why, like, you know, when it comes to the comparison of social media, like something that's always so striking, like even when you take it back to the parenthood thing, like there are literally endless forums of just moms talking at each other about these things. And sometimes they can be really healthy and positive. Sometimes they're out here like calling CPS on each other and like becoming a breeding ground for TERFs. Like it runs the gamut, right? But what is exceptional about it is that there's almost never men doing this, almost never dads doing it. They don't give a shit. They are not concerned with, am I doing this right? Yep. Am I being perfect at that? They just don't care. And is that better? Probably not. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But what is clear is that there is a whole level of additional psychic burden that they are not taking on because they are not consumed with things beyond like, am I meeting the basics? And let's be clear, even some of them are not meeting the basics. But if you're not able to differentiate between like actually doing your job and like optimizing every single nice to have in your life, like then I think the clear message is you are way too obsessed with yourself and have to find a way to back out of that, because it's, you could go down that rabbit hole forever about everything.
Yeah. And I think that is like the trap. I think a lot of people do. I watched a video that you did, Chelsea, a couple years ago where you talked about envy on social media and like, you know, how you handle that. And I would love for you to share with our listeners how you've handled envy and comparison on social media and your tips for them.
Anything that makes me feel bad for even a second, I get out of my face and never see again.
And that's it, folks.
Well, I'm obsessed with that. I'm obsessed that you actually do that because I haven't been able to do that yet. How have you gotten yourself to be able to do that?
Oh, I just mute people, mute words, mute terms. No offense. Love you. Love that for you. But no thanks. Don't want to ever see it again. At least not until I'm out of a specific situation. And like, I think also there is, so I definitely do not struggle with self-doubt. I struggle with, if anything, self-aggrandizement. I'm like, I actually think I'm great. So I don't know what the rest of you are doing. And sometimes the only thing that really kills me, I'm almost never like jealous of someone else from like a perspective of like, oh, I wish I was doing something as good as that. Because like, usually if I see something that I really respect and I'm like, wow, you killed that shit, I reach out to that person and I'm like, this was amazing. Let's be friends. Like I like annex people that I respect. So it's usually not that. I think it's more like bitterness when I feel that people who are undeserving of something succeed. It particularly upsets me in the personal finance space because, as I mentioned, there are a lot of scammers. And to have any shred of ethics in this industry comes at great cost.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it's especially like during the crypto era. And like, anyway, so point being like that, Like, there are a few scammers that I'm like, if I am ever diagnosed with a terminal illness, which hopefully I will not be, I'm releasing all of the tapes. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'm taking you out with me is my message. Or even like, you know, I mean, I think with any industry that you're in, any kind of thing that you're passionate about, there will always be people that you feel like, why are they? Yeah. I mean, Emilia Perez just won multiple Oscars. You know what I mean? Like, enough. Like, so for that, I think what's very important is to have like a strong sense of self of like, you know what? Actually, sometimes shitty things are successful for a combination of reasons that I don't have access to. And I'm allowed in my heart of hearts to know that I am better than that, you know? Yeah.
I could not agree more. I kind of with you have just been like, if I even catch a whiff of you trying to fearmonger me about something, I'm gone. If you are coming across as this is the only way, this is the best way, gone. If you talk about cold plunging, gone. Like,
life is not, too short.
I'm not interested in it. But also, like, you know, having a platform, having boundaries with how I'm treated in my comments. I'm not tolerating it. Like, blocked immediately. You want to come on and say something stupid? Blocked. Like, I am not going to sit here and tolerate, like, this need to be benevolent simply because, like, I happen to be a therapist.
For sure. Yeah. Also, like, I don't know how you deal with it because I would say the vast majority of therapists on the internet are bad. Just straight up bad.
The last episode that we just had, Amanda and I broke down the Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. And part of what we struggle with in our space as well is that a lot of times there are a lot of therapists that are not actually therapists. They are self-help gurus and coaches, and a lot of them throw the title around very willy-nilly. It's very frustrating because a lot of these self-help gurus, they grab on to like singular topics, right? Like, for example, Mel with Let Them. Multiple times she says, this is the thing that will change your life. And I think we can even zoom out using that principle to like any industry that hold space on the internet, right? Like in terms of education and information, it all has to be like so bite-sized, and nuance is just the most offensive thing in the world because, well, why are you overcomplicating it? Like, why are you making it so complicated? It's really straightforward. And it's like, sure, for maybe two people, it is that straightforward. For a lot of people, Let Them is not that straightforward. Like, why are we like encouraging this language that allows people to like simultaneously hate themselves because they can't apply this information, but then continually trying to find this simple, like one track minded, like tidbits that they think will keep making it better. Like, it's just, it's so messy and convoluted, and it ends up just having people like stuck in place, going all the way back to the beginning where we talked about analysis paralysis. And then nobody does anything different, and we're all in the same space, and we're all still unhappy, and we wake up tomorrow and we do it all again.
What is so frustrating about it is, like, generally speaking, if you're any kind of actual subject matter expert, like, you will go so far out of your way to downplay your expertise and to be very narrow about your discipline and narrow about where you can really weigh in on something. I think that there's an obsession in a lot of the online self-help circles of hyper-diagnosing everyone else and never really looking at yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, as a general rule of thumb, like, it is never helpful to diagnose someone else with a mental health issue, especially to their face. Like, that is in no way going to help the relationship improve. And it is extremely unlikely that they will ever hear that and be like, oh, okay, you're right. I should reflect on this.
Well, and I'm like, I have clients that I am hesitant to diagnose with things because I'm like, no, you're just responding to your life. Mm-hmm. Like, based on the situation and what you're going through, of course you're having trouble sleeping. Like, your example, when you're like, I need $200,000 in a tranquilizer. Like, find me someone who wouldn't need a tranquilizer if they need to come up with $200,000. Like, it's just, you are allowed to respond and react to the things that happen to you in your life. And you are not doing it wrong because your specific situation requires specific approaches that wouldn't work for the next person or wouldn't work for me or you or whatever. Like, you are allowed to make independent choices for your life. And I think to like loop the money thing back into this as well, something that I try to empower my clients with, and I would love to know your thoughts on this, Chelsea, is this idea of like, instead of worrying about like what is the best thing to do or the best thing to invest in or whatever, like, why don't you spend some time assessing why money feels so intimidating? Like, spend some time thinking about like why it feels so daunting to just sit down and look at your checking account or like open your credit card app and look at what we're really dealing with here. You know, like, you have to meet yourself where you're at in order to know like how you can even approach something to do it differently or what you even have to do. If you continue to just perseverate on this, like, well, maybe if I do this or if I do this or if I do this, well, you don't even know where you are. So like, how do we know what to do?
I totally agree with that. And I think for money in particular, my most Republican belief is that most self-respect at some level comes from self-discipline and self-accountability.
Yeah.
At some level. And so I definitely think that with the financial aspect of it, because I'm someone who used to be extremely avoidant with money, extremely anxious with it. And I think that there was part of what was keeping me in that cycle for so long. And this is why like girl math was my nemesis for a while, because I was like, this framing of thinking of yourself as incapable of doing it, or that's just not the kind of person you are, or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, there's such a tendency, and it really dovetails with this self-help stuff and this really bad therapy talk, to self-infantilize, to really pathologize any part of our day-to-day life or personality that is difficult for us. Like, if something doesn't come easily to us, we sort of just think, well, this is just not something I'm able to do. And then if we're not able to do it for long enough, well, that's just part of, you know, who I am. And it's intrinsic to my personality. And I don't buy that. I think that there's probably, for every dozen things you could say that about, there's probably one or two for which that's true. There's probably a lot of them that like, you probably could make it work. It's just a question of changing habits, exercising some self-accountability, and even sometimes external accountability. For the first several years of my financial journey, I was relying on other people to help keep me accountable. Like, literally other people had my cards. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes you can also bring other people into it if you're not able to do it yourself at first. But like, and you can also set really, really small initial goals. When we're advising someone who is like at a complete standstill with money, the only thing we ask you to do is literally do nothing else but look at your accounts for the next however many, because it is pretty much not universal, but it is very likely that just the act of doing that will put you on you'll start to want to do something about it. But I do think that there is this tendency that is often exacerbated by how we talk about these things on social media to, again, give up on things or allow ourselves to become overwhelmed with things that aren't effortless for us. And I think that at every point we need to lean out of that, because I think, and part of it is like, I've become very nihilistic about this post-election, because, you know, I'm sure we're all pretty left of center here. And one thing you can do at any and all times is get on social media and watch people left of center rip each other apart while the right consolidates power at all levels, right?
Yep.
And I think that there is, I actually now have a much more cynical view on that, which is that I think for a lot of people, that act of infighting online feels, you get to feel like you're doing something constructive. And you get to feel morally superior without actually having to do anything of use or value. And
or change your life at all.
Or change your life. And I think similarly, when it comes to something like getting our own, and this is very Jordan Peterson of me, but I have to say it, like getting our own life in order, getting our own finances in order.
Yes.
Throwing up our hands and pathologizing ourselves and being like, well, I just can't do this. And so I'm just going to talk about it. And like you said, read about it, think about it, talk about it, scroll about it, and never do anything. It really lets us off the hook. And I think we will never get out of these cycles personally or collectively until we start holding ourselves accountable.
Oh. Sermon. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm in recovery from an addiction, and a huge part of my recovery was, and it was, you know, it's been over 10 years now. So it was a different landscape that I lived in, but right. It was like, look at your finances, pay your parking tickets.
Yes.
Pay your bills, like clean your house, do these things that you've been avoiding. And it was unbelievably empowering. Like, it was terrifying and it was really hard, but it was really empowering. And sometimes I do worry a lot that we are losing that with the pattern that's been going on. And people are really missing out on the confidence you get from doing things that are difficult and scary. Obviously, there's a line, but still.
That line is actually a lot farther than people want to give it credit for. Yes. that line of what is like truly scary and I know this is exactly what you were alluding to, but like that line of what is truly like threatening or scary is actually like a mile down the road. Like, there's a lot of things that we could be doing before we actually get to that space where we need to be like, ooh, is this actually unsafe? But I love that you use the word confidence, Amanda, because I am telling my clients all the time, especially around people that have scarcity mindset with money or feel overwhelmed by it or kind of feel paralyzed or kind of like the hoarding mentality, right? Like, once they have it, they can't ever spend it. Like, to spend it means that they're giving it up and they're being irresponsible or whatever. And I think the only way that you can actually start to build trust with yourself is to do things where you build trust with yourself. So like,
totally.
You have to start, like, I'm sure for you, there was a moment where you were like, okay, like, I need to have a credit card in my wallet again. Like, I need to figure out how to have that in my wallet and not immediately reach for it every single time. Or like Amanda, for you, that following through on,
you have to eventually stop drinking if you want to stop drinking. Exactly.
You had to at some point, like, stop ordering drinks and going to the liquor store and finding excuses to drink and drinking all the time, right? Like, I completely agree with you, Chelsea, that we're losing this, and maybe losing might be a little dramatic, but I think refusal to engage, I think, might be the stronger term of just this idea that we have become way too self-centered and focused on this idea of like internal growth at all costs, but you can't question me while I'm on that journey because everything that I'm doing is like inherently right because it's just me.
You know? Well, and to that point, first of all, Amanda, 10 years, hello, that's amazing. But I think what is, I think, a common thread there, and like AA, oh, I don't know if you did AA, but like any kind of like, okay, 12-step program, what's significant about it is it's like entirely community oriented. You're getting out of your house. You're going to a place with other people. You're supposed to be mostly focused on other people and how you can help them and how you can repair relationships with them. And like, it is not entirely selfless, but there is a huge component of it that is oriented externally and also involves in-person interaction. And I do think like that is something that is hugely absent from obviously so much of American life now, but especially when we talk about whether it's our mental health, our financial health, our, you know, just kind of day-to-day getting by, there's such a focus and obsession on how do we feel? How are we experiencing this? What do we want? And all of that. And I really think like people don't even allow themselves to understand when they're going down that logical path. Like that is like the most distilled libertarian worldview that you could ever come to. It's like, it's literally the way Ayn Rand, like when someone asked if Ayn Rand was afraid to die, she said, no, because when I die, the world dies with me. Like, because she viewed herself as like the locus of the entire universe and didn't really extend the same level of humanity to anyone else around her. And I think that when we look at a lot of this discourse around our own experiences in life, there's such a sense of like, we are at the center of it and everyone else is sort of essentially background characters in our own life and experience. And I think until people, and that's very American, like there are so many other cultures where it's the reverse and you really see yourself as not that important and the community as being all important, and kind of without fail, those are the happier cultures.
Yep.
Love that. Well, thank you so much, Chelsea, for coming and sharing all of your wisdom and nuance with us.
Thanks.
Where can people learn more and follow you?
So I run The Financial Diet. We are primarily on YouTube, but we're also on social media. We have a newsletter, all that kind of good stuff. And then I am on TikTok and Instagram personally at Vegan Chelsea.
Amazing.
Thanks so much, Chelsea. We loved this. This was so great.
I loved this too. This was so much fun. And I can't wait to have you on our platform to dismantle bad therapy culture.
Therapy speak. I'm ready, girl. You just let me know.
I will.
Thanks, Chelsea. Thank you. Bye.